Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
A new space race and dust from an ancient asteroid. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Delays in NASA's human moon missions called Artemis have raised concerns from members of Congress that China will land humans on the moon before the U.S. We'll speak with the Washington Post's Christian Davenport about those concerns and the congressional response to the delays. Then, a capsule containing samples from the asteroid Bennu has finally been opened after being stuck shut for months. We'll speak with Tom Zega about what this ancient space rock contains and the next phase of the OSIRIS-REx mission. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA had originally planned to land astronauts on the moon by 2025, but now expects that to happen no earlier than September of 2026. It's blaming safety concerns and technical issues for the postponements. But there are others racing to get to the moon, and members of Congress expressed concerns that China would send astronauts back before the U.S. Former NASA Administrator Mike Griffin spoke of the lack of urgency from the U.S. to send astronauts before another nation does at a congressional hearing earlier this month.
To allow a situation to develop where the human frontier is populated by our adversary and we are not there should be unacceptable to this nation and to our Western and Asian partners.
Here to talk more about these political concerns with the race to the moon is Christian Davenport, a reporter at the Washington Post covering space and science. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's so great to be back.
It's great to have you on. We have lots to talk about, and I invited you to talk about some reporting you did on the Artemis delays and some congressional concerns, but I think there's something a little more pressing I'd like to ask you about, and that is the end of the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars. Tell us a bit about what we know about the demise of this little bugger and the legacy that it leaves behind.
Yeah, this was a demonstration mission. It was sort of an add-on to the Mars Perseverance rover, which landed on the Red Planet. And Ingenuity is this little 4-pound drone of a helicopter that went along for the ride. And the idea was, you know, they were just going to see if they could fly it in the very thin Martian atmosphere, which is just really 1% of the density of Earth. And they were going to give it a try over the first 30 days or so, hoping they might get in 5 flights. And instead, that little thing kept going and going and going. It was a little helicopter that could. It actually lived for 3 years and flew a total of 72 times before, I guess, earlier this month, as it was coming down, it hit some of its rotor blades on the surface. And one or more of the blades broke off, and they sort of announced the very sad news that Ingenuity would not be flying anymore.
But it's not all sad news, right, Chris? I mean, when you talk to people at NASA, this is kind of laying the groundwork for future drones or aircraft that can accompany rovers on future missions, right? I mean, this is a really exciting future for rovers, is it not?
It is, 100%. And you're right. It is absolutely a good news story. It gives NASA a whole new dimension in its exploration. I mean, the rovers are there on the ground. They have orbiters up in space going around Mars. But this, if you can have the ability to have a helicopter hovering, a few dozen feet off the surface, that really allows you to have a different perspective on the ground. And Ingenuity and potentially now other helicopters that would go to Mars would be able to act as scouts and looking ahead at the terrain for the rovers to seeing how perilous it could be, or going into craters as Ingenuity did, where a rover may not be able to go, and actually then opening that up and those areas up, that terrain up, for NASA scientists on the ground to see places they could not otherwise see.
Well, Chris, let's change gears. Let's go from Mars to the moon. You wrote a piece earlier this month, concerns rise China might reach moon before NASA's return. Let's talk a bit about why these concerns have popped up. There's been some delays announced to NASA's Artemis program. What do we know?
Yeah, so the Artemis program is, of course, NASA's quest to return astronauts to the moon. They had the Artemis 1 flight at the end of 2022 that flew the Orion capsule without anyone on board around the moon. Artemis 2 was the next flight in that mission. It was going to have four astronauts on board, three from NASA, one from Canada, and to go around the moon. That was scheduled for late this year in 2024. But now that's being pushed back to no earlier than September 2025. And concurrently, the lunar landing, which would have been the first time astronauts touched down on the moon's surface since the last of the Apollo missions, Apollo 17 in 1972, that also is going to be delayed to September 2026. These, I think, resonated with Congress. I don't know how much it was a surprise within the space community, but anytime there's a slippage, it's going to get people's attention, particularly when it has to do with, you know, astronaut safety and the development of these complicated programs. And especially at a time when, you know, it does appear we really are in a space race, this time not with the Soviet Union, as we were during the Cold War, during the Apollo era, but with China, which is also aiming to send astronauts to the lunar surface and to look at the South Pole of the moon, and has shown some extraordinary capability to be able to regularly land spacecraft on the lunar surface.
What do we know about China's space program, and are these ambitions for them to get to the moon, or are they really on a path to get there first?
Well, they are on a path to get there. It's a question as to whether they're going to get there before the United States. And we should say that obviously the United States has been there before, but before we can return there. I mean, they have been, you know, really methodically working through their lunar program and landed a spacecraft on the lunar surface in 2013, which was the first time anybody had done that since that Cold War space race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So they became the third country to do that. But then in 2019, they landed a spacecraft on the moon's far side, which was a historic mission because nobody had ever done that before. And the following year, they actually did a sample return mission. And now what they're looking to do later this year is to do another sample return mission from the far side. And that would be, you know, really significant. We've seen recently a lot of attempts to land on the moon, and a lot of them have not been successful, which shows you even, you know, after all of these years, how hard it is to do. And China has shown not only is it very capable, but it's also very ambitious in keeping with this methodical program and going to the moon.
All the while they're advancing their human spaceflight program, right? With a space station in low Earth orbit, correct?
That's right. And they are flying crews regularly to that station. Again, that teaches them a lot, and they can use that as a stepping stone to get to the moon. They can learn how to keep astronauts alive in space for extended periods. They have to be able to rendezvous and dock with the space station with their spacecraft, which is really important. They've shown, you know, on the lunar surface that they're able to land. So they are putting together the pieces. And one of the things that differentiates China between the United States is, of course, they don't have to worry about partisan politics. They don't have to worry about, you know, Republicans and Democrats going at each other and being so divided in the way that we are. And that has really, over the past several decades, disrupted NASA's plans. I mean, you have one administration comes in, says, we're going to the moon. Another presidential administration will come in and say, no, we've been to the moon. We're going to Mars. We're going to an asteroid. And then now we're going back to the moon again. And it's sort of given NASA all sorts of different targets over the years, whereas China has been able to stay focused on what it wants to accomplish.
And this is all because of congressional funding, right? I mean, NASA is reliant on Congress to give it the money to do these things, correct?
Yeah, that's right. But what we have now, at least in theory, is bipartisan support for the Artemis program. I mean, if you think of when the Biden administration came in and following President Trump, They took down all of the scaffolding that President Trump has erected, all of the programs and policies, really, except for two. And that was the Artemis program to return to the moon and the Space Force as the sixth branch of the military. And I think that's in large part because of China's growing ambitions of space. And it's not just a Republican program. Democrats understand how important this is. And the Biden administration has really wholeheartedly embraced this idea that we need to go back to the moon and we want to get there before China, because there is a concern that the norms and behavior and the way that you go about settling the moon and the regulations that sort of dictate behavior on the lunar surface should be dictated in large part by the United States and its allies and not by China.
Does having an adversary in China help the NASA program? Are we seeing shades of the Soviet space race in resource allocation and funding for NASA because there is a geopolitical adversary involved?
I think in some senses, yes. In some senses, no. And let me explain. I mean, I think the fact that the Biden administration embraced Artemis was really significant. I mean, that was the first time you had a human space exploration that would go into deep space, survive subsequent presidential administrations since the Apollo era. We've just never had that before. So that is significant. Whether it's getting the funding to really sustain it, that's another question. I mean, I think, space, particularly when you have a program like Artemis, that wants to send the first woman to the surface of the moon, wants to send the first person of color to the surface of a moon, that has broad appeal. But it's, Congress here in Washington, we say, yeah, sure, they're against crime and they're for education. And sure, we'd love to have the first woman on the moon, but whether they're going to pay for that and pay the enormous resources, we're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to be able to do that is another story. I mean, of course, during Apollo, the NASA's, percent of the budget peaked to 4%. Right now, NASA is just, a half of 1% of the federal budget. So, we've seen increases over time, but whether they're really going to step up and fund NASA at the levels they need to beat China, I think that still remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. So how does NASA square that out? They want to beat China, and they've got, congressional leaders and in presidential administrations are pushing for that. But on the same hand, NASA's also been criticized for overspending, as you mentioned with this. I think in your reporting here, cost of the program for Artemis could reach $93 billion by 2025. That's an enormous cost. How does Congress want NASA to square that in beating China while also not spending hundreds of billions of dollars to do it?
Right. No, that's a great question. And so much of the cost. There are all sorts of new technologies that are coming, but a lot of the costs, as you know, are in the Space Launch System rocket and the Orion spacecraft. That's the vehicle that they flew during Artemis 1. They would use them again in Artemis 2 and Artemis 3. They're enormously expensive, and they were essentially mandated by Congress because they were built in key congressional districts like Alabama and Texas and Florida. So they had key constituencies there, and they're now embedded in the program. In the meantime, though, NASA has started to do things differently and to do more public-private partnerships with the commercial sector, which has some benefits and some drawbacks, of course. But companies like SpaceX have shown enormous capability and enormous cost savings for NASA. And if they can get their Starship rocket going, that could be an enormous boon to NASA. You've got a company like Blue Origin that's also under contract to build a lunar lander. And we can see how the program will shift over time. So I think the combination of new technologies coming on that are more efficient, more cost-effective, along with more congressional support, those are going to have to be sort of the twin strands of the DNA that move the program forward.
We've been speaking with Christian Davenport. He's a reporter covering NASA and the space industry for The Washington Post. Christian, always great to chat with you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Still to come,
looking at the material return from a carbonaceous asteroid like Bennu is really important for understanding also the astrobiological implications of the early solar system.
A sample is back from an ancient space rock what mysteries may it uncover? That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The OSIRIS-REx mission sent a capsule packed with asteroid dirt and dust back to Earth last year, but the majority of the sample that landed in September has been untouched because the capsule was stuck closed. After several months, NASA technicians were able to remove fasteners holding the ancient asteroid material. University of Arizona's Tom Saga is a scientist working on the mission. He joins us now to talk about what the team hopes to uncover now that the sample is, well, uncovered. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you, Tom. And I'm sure you're great to have your hands on this sample from Bennu now that it's back on Earth. But there is an image that your team posted. It's a high-resolution image, and you can see all of these little samples, these rocks, these pieces of dust. And I have to admit, I spent far too much time staring at this because it was so fascinating to see that this is something that came from so, so far away and is here on Earth, and you're able to look at it. I'm wondering what your reaction is when you see an image like that of all of these pristine samples just ready for scientists like yourself to begin analyzing it. What was it like when you saw that?
It's super exciting, right? So I've been doing this kind of work for about 25 years now, and missions like this are really the height of human ingenuity. I mean, to be able to actually build a spacecraft, send it to an asteroid, which is even difficult to see with powerful telescopes, right? Because these things don't have a lot of reflectivity to them. They're very dark in nature, so it's hard to gather enough light to actually even see them with powerful telescopes. So the fact that we could build a spacecraft, engineer a spacecraft, send it to an asteroid, robotically operate this thing, touch down on the surface, and collect material and bring it back to Earth is remarkable for sure, right? Those of us that study meteorites are at the mercy, generally, of what falls from the sky, right? And so we don't have a lot of what geologists might say is context for the meteorites that we get and study in the laboratory. And context becomes really important in terms of telling the story and the history of these materials and the asteroids, which date all the way back to the beginning of our solar system, some 4.567 billion years ago. So getting that context is really important. And until we started doing sample return missions like this, we didn't really have that context. But now that we've actually gone to this asteroid, we've imaged it at very high resolution, we've measured its surface composition, we've looked at the boulders that sort of litter its surface, we know exactly where we took that sample from. And so now we have that context to help tell that story. In terms of the emotions that one feels, myself in particular, felt when looking at that, I'll tell you, it was interesting. The morning when the team was assembled at Johnson Space Center, we were all sitting in a conference room. The curation folks were one floor above us. The sample return capsule was actually in the clean room at that point. And the lid hadn't been opened yet, right? So we were sort of waiting and anticipating that for many days, right? So I think the public saw the feed on NASA television. It was coming through Earth's atmosphere on that Sunday morning. And then it was flown to Johnson Space Center the following Monday, where a group of us were anxiously awaiting its arrival. And so it was sort of put put in the clean room for safekeeping on Monday. That was in the afternoon at that point, and the team desperately needed a break at that point. The recovery team needed a break. They'd been working very hard, long hours, and the decision was made to come back on Tuesday and actually open up the sample return capsule on Tuesday morning to take a look at the sample at that point. So we were all assembled in the clean room. The curation team was up in the clean room, and the science team was in the conference room, one floor below. We had a video feed that we were looking at as the curation team was opening this SRC. And I could tell you could hear a pin drop in that room. Everybody was just waiting for that lid to open to see if there was dust that was coating the inside of that lid. And as they started working, it was like, okay, here we go. Everybody's waiting. And once they opened the lid, all of us were looking at that screen. And I think it was the principal investigator, Dante Loretta, who was sitting closer to the television screen. I was sitting a little bit further back in the room. And he actually said, he's like, oh, there's a lot of dust. There's a lot of dust coating the underside of that lid. And then I think we were all pretty engaged on that screen. And then if you looked, you could see, yeah, there was a lot of dark material, both on the underside of the lid for the sample return capsule, but then also on the deck, the avionics deck that the TAGSAM itself is attached to. You could see dust and actually little stones. And I think at that point, we were super excited to see that, because we knew that was confirmation that there was going to be material inside the TAGSAM itself. And I think it was a measure of excitement and relief, confirming that we knew that we had got sample at that point.
Tom, let's talk a bit about, now that the lid is cracked open, and you're able to start analyzing the sample, what is the next steps? And what are you particularly looking at when it comes to analyzing these samples?
Yeah, so there was, of course, lots of planning that went into the OSIRIS-REx mission, right? All missions have planning, years in the making. I mean, OREX started as a concept in the early 2000s, right? So here we are in 2024, right? So this is a 20-plus year mission. It transcends generations of scientists, really. I mean, when it was first being planned, the OSIRIS-REx mission, I was a graduate student, right? And if you had told me then that I'd be one of the co-investigators on the mission for asteroid sample return, and that we would be doing this sort of groundbreaking science, and that I would have the opportunity and the privilege to look at samples from a new world like this, I probably wouldn't have believed you at the time. And so it's really incredibly fortunate that I get to do this and actually get to look at these samples. So that being said, there is a sample analysis plan. So there's a detailed plan for the types of measurements that are to be done on the sample. There is also a detailed curation plan. So step-by-step procedures of how the TAGSAM would be disassembled, how material would be removed, how it would be triaged and cataloged. And as we speak, the curation team at Johnson Space Center is going through those steps right now, and they're pretty far along in the process now, and sample has been allocated to the science team, which includes investigators both within the United States and around the world. So you can imagine a sample like this, which is incredibly valuable and precious, especially after we've spent $1 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money on bringing back a sample from an asteroid, that we are going to bring the most sophisticated analytical techniques to bear on measuring this sample property. So we will be looking at things like the chemical composition of the sample, what elements are there, in what quantities are they there. We'll be looking at the isotopic composition of the sample. So what, not just what elements, but what isotopes of those elements occur in the sample, in what proportions do they occur, in what mineral phases do they occur. And then, of course, we'll also look at the detailed mineralogical makeup of the sample and piece all of that together as a means to telling the story and history of the materials that make up asteroid Bennu.
And Tom, finally, what, you know, by doing that analysis, what are some of the questions that you have that you hope you're able to answer as you're examining these samples from the asteroid Bennu? What do you want to know?
Yeah, sure. So one of the important things about missions like this is making the link or the connection between what we can see telescopically out there in our solar system with what actually arrives on Earth. So as I noted earlier, those of us that study meteorites are at the mercy of what falls from the sky, right? And so we've tried to piece together the story and the history of our solar system based on what has rained down on Earth for decades, even hundreds of years, right? And of course, our analytical capabilities have gotten more sophisticated and more sensitive as time has gone on. And we're at a point now where we have electron microscopes that can easily show us the atomic scale structure of materials, including those that make up these kinds of asteroidal samples. So we've tried to piece together the materials that make up things like asteroids based on meteorites. And I sometimes liken it as, imagine you were given a leaf, and then from that leaf, you had to reconstruct the whole tree. That's sort of an analogy of what we try to do when we get a meteorite and we're trying to reconstruct, you know, what type of asteroids do these come from? Where in the solar system do the materials that make up these meteorites form? How old are they, et cetera, et cetera? So a mission like OSIRIS-REx, which targeted a carbonaceous asteroid, specifically because we thought that it would contain organic compounds. It may have histories of reactions with water. Some of these asteroids, we think, based on decades of study of meteorites, once had active hydrothermal systems, much like those that that are occurring on Earth and that geologists study on Earth. So being able to analyze this return sample and then make that link between what we see in this return sample, what we see in meteorites that we've been studying for decades, and then what the folks that do telescope type of work, where they can actually look at asteroids both in near Earth space and also out in the asteroid belt, and they've been trying to classify asteroids for years. These kinds of missions help us make those links, and they also help teach us about the makeups of the asteroid itself. So looking at the material return from a carbonaceous asteroid like Bennu is really important for understanding also the astrobiological implications of the early solar system.
Looking forward to seeing what you and the team find out about this incredible sample. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's exciting, and I appreciate being on your show.
That was Tom Zega, a professor at the University of Arizona and scientist on the OSIRIS-REx sample mission. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. And we are welcoming a new intern to the show, Emily Ching. Welcome, Emily. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.